It looks like for this month, when we're celebrating poetry and Poetry Month in April, that a lot of it is geared toward, well, particularly younger kids.
Yes.
K through 12. So when you commented to me that the news is the old news, that it's all about the kids, it's kind of been who everybody's been addressing for a long time, right?
It's true.
Yeah.
And it's no mystery. Those kids are us.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we speak to them, we're speaking to the best of ourselves, or, you know, they're going to come forward and be our better selves.
How much of it involves getting them involved in writing poetry?
Well, it first gets them thinking about it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's far less intimidating, far less scary. Writing poetry is an interesting end game. Thinking it through, having a poetic nature, having a poetic thought, I think is more primary. And I think that is vested in, you know, great stories that we hear, great moments that stay with us, the aroma of coffee in the morning, wherever it comes from. It's different from actually writing the poem. So I think first getting anybody, kids included or adults, to recognize the poetic moment, the feeling of that, whatever it is. And I think that's where it starts.
When you just said that, I realized that we all resonate to music.
Mm-hmm.
Not everyone can play.
Mm-hmm.
Not everyone can put two notes together that sound well, but we are all of us involved in that. We're involved in reading something, unfortunately.
We are. You know, in your music analogy, by the way, are we musicians if we listen to music? It's an interesting thought.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we love it. We appreciate it. We may not be the makers of it, but the makers require the other end, you know, the listeners, the appreciators. And I think in that sense, there's a symbiotic relationship.
When you talk about music, literature, and I'll separate poetry out because it's our discussion today and it's Poetry Month, it's all about resonating, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah,
it is.
As a human being, you encounter Eric Satie or you encounter Wagner. You resonate to one and not the other or both.
Mm-hmm.
Or that's the pathway. It's a door that gets open. Then you find, wow, in there I found this place I resonated.
Yeah.
And poetry was kind of removed from that. I guess in our lifetime, it became that thing that...
red ink. it was delivered to us in some version of red ink. You have to do this. You have to memorize this. And if you get something off, you're wrong, which is counterproductive.
Mm-hmm. Well, as we celebrate Poetry Month.
Yes.
I'm going to ask you this question. I think that a lot of people try to write poetry. I think there's... Once you've encountered it and you read that poet that resonates to you, whoever that is, that helps you find your own voice or maybe your own voice that's mimicking other voices.
Mm-hmm.
And while you might never share that, you try. I might not tell Alberto Rios that I'm hearing my poem. How does that person know?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, but I think in trying, they know. That's the test. I don't think it's the product. I think it's the impulse. I think it's the sensibility. I think it's the appreciation that maybe I didn't write the poem somebody else might have written, but I wrote the poem I needed to write.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a grace in that. And I think it's an important one. And I think personally, we all do something like that, even if it's just remembering something. Sometimes when you were talking about resonance might be the moment, but it might be the moment remembered. And I think there's an important part of poetry that plays to that. And music and poetry were originally not separate things. They were often thought to be pretty much the same thing. You know, something like Anglo-Saxon prosody, which was very specifically both musical and story-ish or original poem. We think of it as story, but it's really poem. And in the form gives us a way to remember the schematic of Anglo-Saxon prosody is a mnemonic device. It helps us remember, and that becomes poem, and music becomes part of it. So if you've got two hard beats in the first half of an Anglo-Saxon prosodic line, the middle caesura or that pause was the lute strum. It's like da 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 da, boom. You know, that feeling that isn't word, but is certainly part of the moment. So there's, again, that symbiosis of something that has no word and some words that help us get to it.
You took us there, so I'm going to back up to this, the idea of music and words.
Yes.
And minstrel. Minstrel's a word that's almost abandoned now. And it had its own baggage, I guess, in the early 20th century with minstrel shows.
Sure.
The appropriateness of that. But minstrels have been around forever, and minstrels and poets were the philosophers.
Oh, absolutely. And we forget that what's called prosody, or the formal structures in poetry. We're in a free verse time, and that's, you know, going back to certainly at least the 60s, but it's old. But the more formal structures, let's say a sonnet or Anglo-Saxon prosody I mentioned earlier, or you know, villanelle, whatever we might imagine, those structures are also musical structures. So when you find a good poem that's written in a form, like a sonnet, it also has a musical analog. And so if you take, which is kind of surprising to people, so many poems, like let's say Robert Frost's Whose Woods These Are, that very famous iconic poem, can be sung. But they can be sung to things that are familiar. You don't have to invent them. There are structures that are out there. So, for example, that particular poem can be sung to Hernando's Hideaway. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though, and so on. You can hear it. You feel it right away. And so we have this nonsensical, perhaps, Hernando's Hideaway. But underlying that is the musical basis, and it is far more widely applicable and memorable than the words. We always think, you know, I was a child of listening to music in the 50s and 60s, and I think those are the worst lyrics in the world, you know. But it wasn't simply about the lyrics. There was something bigger at work in all of that, so that you could embrace silly lyrics if they helped you to remember something about the musical feeling in yourself. And then you start to make up your own lyrics, you know, as we so do, those mondegreens where we create our own, what we think we're hearing. And somewhere in there, that poetic process is at work. Yeah. And it's the minstrel in us that's supplying the moment as it should have been.
When I was reading a couple of your things today, and then I looked over to a poet that I very much like, Donald Hall.
Yes.
And I think of this tradition of, well, I don't know, do you think of yourself as being in the tradition of Frost at all?
Well, I think of myself as being probably in the narrative tradition, those clear, clean, by clean I mean just spare storytellers who give over the idea pretty plainly. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm in that tradition, yes.
I was going to say about Frost.
Yes.
There's reading the poem and then living it for a time, and then you read someone's analysis of it and you realize he was going to commit suicide. That's why he said that. Two tramps and mud times about what? You know? when you're celebrating Poetry Month.
Yes.
And you're encouraging people. Well, I guess that's it. I mean, it's one thing to say, it's Poetry Month. So what are we encouraging? Share ideas? Mm-hmm. Find a poem, go to the website. What do we want to have happen?
I love the mystery of that question. I don't know that there's a simple answer to it. The simplistic answer is go find a poem and read it. And of course, that is something we should do, but we don't need a month to do that. It is simply a reminder that we have that quietly in our sphere, in our radius, everywhere we go all the time. And I think it's closer to that. National Poetry Month is a reminder of something that's bigger and that is all the time and is something we can participate in. So that we go back, we look at a poem, we go, I love that. I wonder if there are other things I love, or simply I love, which I think is a nice reminder.
And while it's nice to approach kids, and all the disciplines that I grew up with are largely ignored or have been for a long time by our educational system of the arts, and I would put poetry and literature there. Mm-hmm. Simply requiring somebody to memorize something doesn't make it history, right? But while it's admirable to reach out to children, poetry, I think, even more than music, you can come to it any time. You're not too late to the party. Mm-hmm. You can discover all of this that you said, nah, I don't have time for that. I got my MBA to get. I got to do this. I got to do that. And now at 60, 70 years old, I'm going to discover poetry. You find those voices all the time that did and found something in it.
That's right.
So in Arizona, what are we doing as the Poet Laureate?
Well, I am making visits all over the place, but primarily what I think I'm doing is having an ongoing, profound, constant conversation about language. We can call it poetry. We can call it whatever we want. It's about language and how we are bettered because of it. That language in all of its incarnations, so let me say languages, are solutions. They're not problems. And if we can just simply work toward that idea that there's a better word, the word we know may not be the only word for something, and that there might be more in our lives as a result of learning two words for something and then being able to choose in the right moment which is the better. That easily might be knowing more than one language, but within English, which has got more words than any other language, basically 500,000 words, we can do quite a bit. I am the judge of, not the judge, I'm the MC and have been for a number of years now of the state of Arizona Spelling Bee. And one of the things I get to talk to the kids ahead of time, they're nervous, and I give them kind of a talk about what they're doing, this idea of spelling and words and what they're in the middle of. And I always ask them if they've seen Harry Potter. They go, yeah, you know, they've all seen Harry Potter. And I say, well, who's the most powerful wizard in Harry Potter? And they all have different names that they say, you know, Harry and Dumbledore, whatever. And I say, no, you know, the most powerful wizard in Harry Potter is J.K. Rowling and her magic wand. And that's how they do all of these things, is the same as your magic wand. And it's called a pencil or a pen or a keyboard. And that thing they do that's magical is they cast spells. Well, that's what you're doing. It's the same root. You are spelling. You are, by virtue of putting a word into the world in this moment, either by spelling it out loud or writing it on a piece of paper, in this moment, we forget the power of that. You are bringing forward something from 500,000 other choices and making it be, because you have beckoned it. That's a pretty powerful idea. That by spelling, this is, you were saying that the things that we grew up with are backgrounded now. Well, spelling, you know, we put a big show on about it, but spelling, for example, is a very powerful act. And that leads us toward better language. It leads us toward understanding that language itself is powerful. And I also get to tell them that, you know, all right, but it doesn't end here. You may win today, but it doesn't end here. Say a dictionary is efficient, but a poem is effective. And there's a big difference. You may have all the words in the world, but if you don't do something with them, and it doesn't take very many, you don't need them all. You need the right ones. We can start to talk about poetry and, you know, or just better communication, period. But poetry specifically.
When you're saying those kinds of things, and you mentioned the English language.
Yes.
And I don't know about you, when I was growing up, it was all French. Everything's German is the guttural language. Everything sounds angry. French is, if you could speak French, that's real poetry. And Spanish. But I've never found a language that I thought could do so many nuanced things. And it's almost, I guess, like Dvorak coming to this country as a composer in 1893 and looking at all the composers here and saying, why are you ignoring the countryside? You've got all this music here.
Right.
Why don't you embrace it? We've been doing that for years, and he writes the New World Symphony using, you know, Negro spirituals, telling Americans, go out and listen to this. We're always so quick to dismiss our own language. Well, English is very matter-of-fact. I think English is a perfectly beautiful language. And when you're talking to people about finding the right word, it's also in English, all languages, but in English, you can make something so easily left-brained. You can make a love letter sound like a business entreaty. You can make a business entreaty sound like an invitation to a love affair.
Sure.
just in that nuance of language to get us to think about saying yes to poetry.
It's all in there, but we get lazy and we create habits of only certain words that we're going to use, and we start to do that. We forget, as you are saying, the great depth, length, breadth of the language. And English has been smart in its evolution. It's borrowed from every language every time it can't find the word it needs. So English itself even recognizes that I'm going to look anywhere and everywhere for the word that ought to be the right word. And we are very fond of saying the right word, but so often it's the right words. We need more. One doesn't do it. Mm. It's not the end of the story. So that if we go between languages, if I say pen, for example, I have that one word, I know what it is, and so suddenly I own that object. It cannot escape the fact that I know it. I can spell it, I can say its word, and I can make it dance for me. But the moment you know that it's also pluma, let's say in another language, or another word in English, suddenly that single thing has aspects. It has dimensionality. It has more than one way to be. And words help us understand that there's not just one state of being. And we can't be scared of the movement, of the flux, of that great monster change that happens even in the moment you say, oh, pen or pluma, which one am I going to say? And you have a choice right there. And that choice, we were talking about, where does poetry come from? Well, I might say one or I might say the other. What's wonderful is that I have choice. When you don't have choice, that's when I think it gets a little dangerous and harder for us all.
Well, hearing all of this, especially in an election year, and especially in an election year that's
yes.
becoming unlike one that I can, mm-hmm. just the language. I mean, I grew up in my youngest life was the idealism of language,
yeah.
putting statesmanlike pictures to
sure.
to the air, and then we would all try to live up to those, had mm-hmm. things to aspire to excuses, to platitudes,
mm-hmm.
to the visceral. And now, past hyperbole, I'm not even sure where we are now.
Yeah.
But in an election year, language becomes so critically important, and yet it seems like not critically heard.
Right.
Maybe that's where I'm looking for hope in Poetry Month.
Well, I hope so, too. I think that's a good way to think about it. The rhetoric we're hearing now in the political arena is one-sided. That is to say, it's almost not being heard. It is a one-sided declamation. You know, you liar, you whatever. And you're hearing these words that are stunning, and yet they're so over the top as to not have meaning, I think. They may have meaning in terms of votes, and maybe we're going to be scared to death with the consequence of that.
I miss my grandmother until I listen to the political conversations going on. I'm glad she's not having to put up with it.
Well, I know what you mean. I know what you mean. It is, and it's not what second graders should be listening to. You know, we think about quote-unquote bad words or something like that. I'm just reading a book right now in which a little kid is upset that she's heard the word, the S word, which she renders as stupid. Mm. And I think that's a perfect second grader way of understanding the world. And yet, what are they listening to on this big stage? It's scary.
And there again, combinations of words that you can string together.
Yeah.
A metaphor, an analogy, mm-hmm. an elegant thought that another human being reads mm-hmm. and resonates to, rather than reacts to
yeah.
viscerally.
We think of the great political speeches, and they are soaring. They are exemplars. We go back, we study them, we read them. That's not what's happening this time around. And so the great poets, when they were politicians, or really their speech writers, hard to know where these things come from. But those were just privileged moments that you got to hear somebody say something that so moved you. That was a moment of particularity, of singularity, of I am so happy to be in this moment and in this world and to have heard that. I don't think we're registering that this time around. in any fashion.
No, and it's nice to have the reminder. If you haven't checked out poetry in a while, do it now. Yeah. What are you working on now?
I'm working on a lot of things, and it's hard to say where to start. I've just written some books of fiction, so I'm going to be working with those. But when I write fiction, the truth of it is, I'm a poet through and through. They are big books of poems, is what they are. So, but I've written some fiction, and I am, as poet laureate, traveling around, and I've started writing. I have now for a while, something I call poems of public purpose. These are not poems that are mine. They are written with a different reason, a different intent. And I think they are true to the office of whatever we might imagine poet laureate would be. So they are poems of occasion, of circumstance, of meaning. And I've really been having some fun with those. We also think of poems of public purpose as so often, related to people and what people are always up to. But I include in this nature and what nature is up to. And so I think this public purpose, poems of public purpose, I've been thinking a great deal about what that might mean and how it is something everybody should be able to understand it is, and yet. So let me give you a good example of, I'm using a form often in this called a gregueria, which is something virtually nobody has heard of. And it was something a turn of the last century poet in Spain, Ramon Gomez de la Serna, invented, and it's basically a one-line poem. And the reason why this has been so attractive to me, I've been doing a lot of public art as part of what I'm doing, and in public art, or the public circumstance and poem, you don't often have somebody for half an hour.
Right.
You have them, especially with the advent of everything technology, you have them for 10 seconds at most, and something's got to happen. And so this one-line idea in which he puts together, it's about high seriousness and juxtapositions that lead to an epiphany. And in that epiphany, once you hear it, you're going to laugh because you have made a connection, even though the thing itself may not be funny. This is sort of Spanish literature at its core. So my favorite one that he wrote, by the way, is oddly a little long, and it goes like this. The old sailor on his deathbed asked for a mirror that he might look at the sea one last time. So we go, yes, he's looking at himself. That's the sea. Yes, I get it. You're kind of laughing, but he's about to die. Right? So that's it in a nutshell. Mm-hmm. But so if you've been around Tempe Town Lake, for example, there are all these tiles with writing on them, and that's something I did. That's one of my projects with Carla Elling, my artistic partner, who loaded the 2.5 tons out on there and installed them. But those are designed so that you can go and read only one, or you can turn left and read another one, or you can turn right and read another one, and it doesn't matter what order. You will get something regardless. That's a great talk about. I talk about integrity of the line with my students quite a bit. My students come in and they'll say, Professor Rios, where should the best line in a poem be? And the journalists say, first line, hook line, you got to get them there. Science fiction writers will say, no, it's the ending. I woke as if in a dream, whatever it is. Everybody's got their version of it. And my answer is always the same. No, the best line in a poem better be the line I'm reading. And that's an almost impossible measure. And of course, why wouldn't we want to strive for that? So this idea, we call it integrity of the line. Every line should matter. Every line should do something. That's what these small poems are, in essence, doing. Incidentally, that idea of integrity of the line, or the single line, where's the best line? There's a process that people do. For example, they might open the Bible, and this is where you most commonly see it. Open the Bible, point to a line, and read it, and take courage from that for the rest of the day, or get an answer, or whatever you imagine it will do. And that's called cleromancy. But what people don't know is that was based on an earlier version of that, where people did exactly that same thing with the works of Virgil. And so they didn't read the whole poem. They would open up a book to one of Virgil's poems, and they would just point at a line. And each line was so good that it gave you something for that day. That's how rich, how meaningful, and how seriously it was taken. And so I think this is all legacy to that, and it's all a version of thinking about things in that instance. And poetry itself, that's it. It's, we talk about poetic lines. I don't know what else. We talk about poems, but I think the next thing we think about is the lines in poems, and it's lines that we remember. I'm not sure we remember off the bat whole poems, mm-hmm. but we remember lines. And so there's something in that, the power of that immediate encounter, given word, given, you know, extra meaning or circumstance because of those words, that you are involved in. And I think there's something quite exciting about that.
So you gave us an example of the Spanish
poet. So some that I've written, yeah. For example, along Tempe Town Lake. Let's see. To visit the river quickly, cut an onion. You know, and we're going to laugh, and there's something, but there's some, the body is connected to that water. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not going to go and go through it, but you can get that there's actually something more serious in that very charming or, you know, funny little moment. Mm-hmm. Nobody owns water. Drink some and try to keep it. Junior high school students love that one.
Yeah, I should. I was trying not to laugh out loud.
one that has gotten a lot of play, it's a very simple Arizona one. Rain falls down wet and gets up green.
Nice.
Very simple. Yeah. Very simple. It's these kinds of moments that I think can be very powerful and can lead people to greater poems, mm-hmm. and to think, well, there's more, or I think
Well, it's interesting you would say that, too, because as a songwriter, I think about how it used to be you package songs. And the idea was, on one side of this LP, on one side of this cassette, you want to have a flow to it, but the arc takes you to the end of the first side, and you have to turn it over. And you get to the end of the second side, and you can't wait to flip it back over and start again. We no longer have any control over when someone hears something of yours.
Right.
And because of the internet and the way we disseminate information for our friends, we probably do. Look at this one line by Alberto Rios that I found today, and it's out of context. So it better pop.
It better.
Yeah.
I don't mind that as a challenge. I don't think everything has to do that. Mm-hmm. I don't think everything is effectively served by that. But on the other hand, something should do that, and I don't shy away from that.
There's a poem I showed you that I had found it only this morning. I don't recall this one seeing it before, and I actually found it on the Poetry Foundation page. It's okay. Up there. When giving is all we have.
Yes.
And I'm not sure there's an antecedent to it, and I don't know if it's intended to be part of the poem or if it's an introduction to the poem, that one river gives its journey to the next.
I like to write epigraphs to my – I consider that a poem of public purpose. And
I was going
to
ask.
Yeah, and I like to write epigraphs that are the poem in some few words. Mm-hmm. But what's important about that very particular epigraph, one river gives its journey to the next, was code. And when I tell friends, I mean, my last name is Rios. And so one river – when I had a son, gives its journey to the next, is a way of gifting to my son a sensibility. Mm. That's what it was.
Nice. anything? I see you have that with you. Anything you'd share with us from the?
Sure.
From the
should book? I read? Should I read that?
I would love it if you read.
Oh,
this
let
one.
Me read that. Sure.
I scribbled up there something.
No, that's all right.
Your poem is of public purpose.
When giving is all we have, it begins with the epigraph, one river gives its journey to the next. We give because someone gave to us. We give because nobody gave to us. We give because giving has changed us. We give because giving could have changed us. We've been better for it. We've been wounded by it. Giving has many faces. It is loud and quiet, big if small, diamond in wood nails. Its story is old, the plot worn in the pages too, but we read its book anyway, over and again. Giving is, first and every time, hand to hand, mine to yours, yours to mine. You gave me blue, and I gave you yellow. Together, we are simple green. You gave me what you did not have, and I gave you what I had to give. Together, we made something greater from the difference.
There are moments throughout that. I guess one of the things I admire about your work and anything of yours that I've read, it's that there is the totality of it. There's the impression, the feeling you walk away with all of it. And now I understand better the idea of purpose in each line. But there's usually some enigmatic phrase that on its own doesn't make a great deal of sense to the rational mind. Mm-hmm. It appeals to the poetic sensibility. And then it sticks with you for a while to go back and to say, what is that? What did I miss? How did I not read that correctly? Where is it? The diamond in wood nails.
Yes.
That's just such a beautiful thought.
I know that when I wrote that, you have it pegged. I mean, that's almost the antithesis of what I was saying earlier about clarity and all that sort of stuff. But it was just, to me, a sense of the most prosaic thing I could think of, just a bunch of nails in a toolbox. And then the discovery that, it's almost from childhood, that you'll just, if you look harder, if you see the one thing, it's like why we look down at the ground or why when we're on the beach, you know, we're beachcombing. If you just look harder, you might find a diamond. I don't know where diamonds come from. You know, I mean, it just makes no sense on that other level, except maybe that's where it is. Mm-hmm. And I talk about this all the time, finding an edge in the middle. It's the hard, hard thing to do. We know that an edge is at the edge of things, but who's looking in the middle? Mm-hmm. And I think so that diamond in wood nails is where we would least expect to find it.
It's just beautiful. Well, I'm guilty of one thing. Whenever I sit with you, I realize I could just talk all night, and I don't want to take your whole afternoon. So the encouragement, if not the admonishment, is at least in April to reacquaint yourself with the beauty of language.
Yes.
The demands of language, and sometimes more often than not, the joy that it can bring us.
Yes. And the power. I would go back to that idea of spelling. We're bringing forward, when we read even a poem, we're just taking a few words out of the dictionary. And yet those few words can create something so powerful. Imagine what that great engine is, that dictionary, all those words, all that stuff. Imagine. It's like looking at the stars, except they're words.
That's a beautiful way to end. But when you put it that way, I thought... Now when that's a perspective I've never had before. When you write a poem and you think of all the words you left in the toolbox, it was like fighting with one arm tied behind your back. You know? Alberto Rios, thank you so much.
This has been a pleasure.